Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers. FCBP. Stand for Free the Black Panthers. And fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements with black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we rise up, unity is so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, if you think this shit won't be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fucking promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay,
free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, fuck coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, shit, that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack fucked up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police departments to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prisons. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prisons. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
Our Black Power brothers and sisters, we're getting ready to play part 8 of the series. Y'all know we're covering the human rights atrocities of this pandemic. You're going to continue to hear testimony from attorneys, doctors, scientists, virologists, economists, historians in this crime against humanity. So we're going to continue. So without further ado, here's part 8 of the grand jury of International Human Rights Tribunal on the COVID pandemic. Check it out. Take notes.
I will read in English because my English is un poco awful. I am Ariane Billeron from France. I am philosopher, specialized in philosophy of moral and politics. I am clinical psychologist and doctor in psychopathology, specialized in the study of manipulation, the violence of power, perversion, paranoia, harassment, and totalitarianism. So I will speak from those two points of view. I have taught for several years at the University in France. I have been an auditor and investigator for companies, but also an expert for courts in cases of harassment at work. I have published many books on this subject, some of which have been translated into languages other than French. In the situation we are dealing with, my expertise allows me to say that we are dealing with a totalitarian drift, and I will describe why I think so. This is a totalitarian drift from the point of view of political philosophy, but also from the point of view of psychopathology, which corresponds to a collective delusion, the paranoiac delusion. Paranoia is a contagious psychosis whose masterpiece is harassment, and which functions according to the following structure. A visible or invisible imaginary enemy persecutes us. We must go to war against the enemy, and this justifies the use of harassment, and all means are permitted. It is a delusion of persecution that leads to acting out. The intention to harm is nevertheless safeguarded, which is why I have in the past spoken out on the need for criminal convictions of paranoiac profiles, which are in the majority of cases at work in harassment. In the totalitarian system, the content of the delusion may change. For example, who is the designated enemy, but the troops structure remains the same, the one I just told you. First point, my diagnosis, harassment used against populations with terrible consequences on the mental health of individuals. In the political crisis we are dealing with, typical methods of harassment were used on the people who were victims of repeated moral pressure in order intended to create and maintain a state of terror in the individual. The consequences are terrible for people's mental health. The least we can say is that mental health has not been at all at the heart of the concepts. On the contrary, the damage is considerable. Multiple traumas, depressions, suicides, psychological disorganization, addictions, mental confusion, psychiatric decompensations, especially of schizophrenic type. Many specialists are alarming us, especially concerning children. For example, in January 2021, the head of the Child Psychiatry Department at Necker Hospital in Paris, Dr. Pauline Chast, spoke of an alarming increase in suicide attempts among children and young adolescents in several Parisian hospitals. Mental health disorders are also often factors and triggers of somatic disorders called psychosomatic, affecting the health of the individual. Right now, the end justifies the means, and the logic is sacrificial. It becomes acceptable to sacrifice individuals in the name of quantity, in the name of the greatest number, and the individual is deprived of his human rights. Moral considerations no longer enter into the discourse except to be used in terms of blackmail and manipulation. It would be for the good of the group that the individual should be sacrificed itself. As an example, children's schooling has been sacrificed in many countries of the world for the last 2 years with class closures, greater inequalities, those who have access to the internet and those who don't, brutal class closure, isolation of children leading to depressive ideas. In France, healthcare providers were fired because they refused to undergo experimental injections in a so-called pandemic context where the health system could not logically afford to suspend its staff. Any form of disagreement or even simple questioning encounters censorship and repression in the face of a dogmatic narrative that no one has the right to refute despite the many paradoxes it contains. The French president has repeatedly called on the French people to sacrifice themselves to make efforts in the war against the virus. More globally, whole countries have been locked down, unable to deal with the economic lockdown, with millions of people falling into misery. With this sacrificial logic, individuals no longer count and can be used as objects of experimentation to the point of genocide. There are no longer any moral, legal or spiritual limits. The methods used are sectarian methods. First, terror. An extremely dangerous virus is going to kill us. Two, sequestration, lockdown, restrictions of freedom on freedom of movement and infringement of inalienable fundamental rights, such as freedom of movement, freedom of expression, etc. Three, exclusion and mistreatment. Critical citizens are considered bad, even to the point of calling for murder in some political discourses. For example, in Italy, where personalities from journalism, politics and medicine called for the segregation in trains between the vaccinated and the non-vaccinated, suggesting a thing around the neck for the non-vaccinated, with declarations wishing for the re-establishment of the gas chambers. Some people today have lost everything, jobs, livelihood, parental rights, etc., simply for being opponents of the policies to have been pursued. For example, the refusal of care, as well as the injection practiced without any discernment of individuals with regard to their diversity, are abusive practices that endanger human life without the state taking responsibility for them. In France, being subject to anaphylactic shock is not a criterion for not being subjecting to injection. Four, conflict of loyalty. Forcing individuals to make impossible choices, false choices, for example, between the right to work, to our means of subsistence, and the right to dispose of our own body. It's a false choice. Five, hypnotic suggestions. In particular, something called the hypnotic seal, which induces prohibition of thinking in people through the mass media, with the repetition of deadly accounting discourses and images of panic. Six, censorship and persecution. 7. Repeated traumatic shocks and overtime spent on the population. For example, orders of closure issued at the last moment. Sometimes even orders within orders. Paradoxical discourse. For example, in France, the government has been known to say everything and its opposite sometimes within weeks of each other without ever justifying what was said before. 8. Generalized anomalies. For example, incentives to professionals traditionally not licensing to perform injections like the nutritionist or the physiotherapist or the psychologist for great profit. 9. Guilt stripping of individual, seduction, blackmail, intimidation, threats, refusal of care of some category of the population, lack of education for children, disorganization of spatial and temporal benchmark for the entire world population, surveillance and transgression of people's intimate lives, etc. And this is an asymmetrical context where people have been subjected to the decisions of their leaders and where innocent people have been designated as guilty. For example, children designated as guilty of killing their grandmother. The citizen is treated like a prisoner on parole. The repeated traumatic shocks obtained in this way over time provoked both by political discourses and decisions, but also by the incessant suggestions in the mass media have led individuals in states of traumatic dissociation. It triggers a defense mechanism called denial in psychology, that is the impossibility of representing the violence of a situation that threatens the psychic life. The manipulations of the mass media playing on fear and panic have led to divisions in families, in couples, and in friendships, splitting society into two camps and causing distrust of all against all, from which it will now be very difficult to emerge in order to establish harmony between citizens. Don't we say divide and conquer? The mass media have operated a permanent hypnotic suggestion, reducing the individual to a mathematical unit, a number, or a positive or negative, positive case, negative case. In hypnosis, there is the hypnotic seal, which is very powerful induction that provokes a radical prohibition on thinking on the such and such a subject, like a drawer that is sealed in the psyche. A sect or cult requires adherence to a religious type of faith. The individual is not asked to analyze, but to believe blindly. Persecution and censorship, as well as intimidation, have fallen upon those who wanted to analyze and not believe. A sect or cult always promises the return of a lost paradise. The same thing with the totalitarian system. A sect or cult proposes fetish objects. Here, the Holy Grail was the injection, supposed to free us from evil. Of course, it was a lie. People who were injected twice today lose their rights in many countries if they refuse to pursue in this way. And we can clearly see that it is to lead us further towards a world of global planetary control and surveillance, where the individual will be reduced to nothing at best, to be used as a force of production, at worst, to be annihilated as useless to the capitalist reign. The totalitarian drift is of a sectarian and prophetic nature. Hannah Arendt said, "The scientificity of totalitarian propaganda is characterized by the emphasis it places almost exclusively on scientific prophecy, as opposed to the more traditional reference to the past. The prophecy took place from the beginning with a completely unrealistic and unrealized prediction of the number of days, and I refer to the book I wrote with Vincent Pavant, professor of mathematics, Le Débat Interdit, The Forbidden Debate, which will be published at the beginning of March in France. The totalitarian system places the achievement of its goals in a future that is always distant, a kind of final promise, the return to a lost paradise the end of the Calvary, the purity of the race, the territory purified of disease, the return to the world before, etc. It's a question of uniting the mass against a common enemy, hail the virus, supposedly incarnating the opposition to the achievement of this goal. The enemy, both external and internal, will be susceptible to change. Ideological scientism and its predictive technique never cease to move. Their chameleon dimension keeps them in power. The discourse is no longer a reflection of the experience. It is the experience that must conform to the discourse. We started with predictive models, which we wanted to impose on reality. Let's think of Ferguson predictions in this case. In science, model must always be submitted to reality and not the contrary. French mathematics professor Vincent Parent puts in this way, in the book Le Débat Interdit, so the first postulate was established, Ferguson's models and the calculations that were based on them corresponded to reality. It is precisely from this moment that the collective delusion begins. The delusion of reality was established, and from then on the postulate of the predominance of arbitrary figures resulting from modeling speculation was imposed. Instead of the statistical enumeration of the operational science, those that start from the facts and measure them. There has been a major scientific scene here with tragic consequences for humanity. It's necessary to understand why totalitarianism works on the populations. It works on the populations because in totalitarianism there is a promise made. This is a promise that will not be kept, of course. The promise to the people is to take full responsibility of the suffering of their existence and be returned to a lost paradise. This is what was set up at the beginning in Western countries. We take care of you completely. Stay at home. We pay you. Don't think anymore. We think for you. Get vaccinated and everything will go back to the way it was. Don't think, we think for you, etc. From the point of view of psychology, the profiles that instigate harassment are perverse and or paranoiac profiles, so-called narcissistic profiles. But in the case of perversion, the criminal responsibility is engaged because there is no delusion constriction. While in the case of paranoia, the question is more debatable since it is a delusion of persecution. Nevertheless, the paranoiac individual is fully aware of harming. He even justifies it. He clearly intends to harm. And the intention is justified by pseudo-ideals, the common good, health for her, for all, etc., as we have already seen in former totalitarian regimes. The paranoiac does not necessarily believe in the content of his delusion. It's rather a way of being of the world, a way of persecuting where the other is seen as an enemy. And we can make the hypothesis that the instigators of this tragic development for the peoples have this relation to the world, a relation to the world made of anguish, of persecution, of narcissistic rigidity, in which the peoples are seen as enemies, a world population considered as too big and to be eliminated in some eugenistic perspective. Clearly, the totalitarian system functions according to a pathological structure, which is one of paranoia. Mass psychosis is created by paranoiac profiles. Also, it needs the alliance of different pathological profiles, notably the perverse, cynicism, instrumentalization. They are the ones who don't believe in the discourse of persecution, but generally they get considerably richer from the crisis that they have contributed to create, for example, for their own profit, and the psychopath, mercenaries of the regime to continue to exist. The paranoiac delusion persecutes in the name of what is prophesied, and what is prophesied, it simply makes it happen. There will be a lot of deaths, it says, and in fact, by repeatedly prohibiting treatments that cure patients and making populations more precarious, these days are coming. Moreover, the ideological narrative justifies the persecutions by self-defense. With paranoia, it's allowed to kill because it wasn't self-defense. In paranoiac delusions, there are ideas of delusion hypochondria, and this is what leads to mass Munchausen syndrome, which is the inappropriate over-medicalization of a common viral disease, which would deserve proper and early care, denying the temperance, warnings, and experience of experts, and creating more problems and suffering than it solves. In the delusion hypochondria of paranoia, the disease is everywhere, experiences and as dangerous, deadly, the enemy of the living. The sick is opposed to the healthy as the impure to the pure. Orders are given to eliminate the part of the social body designated as impure. The supposed impurity is to be hunted down by terror and radical methods. The end justifies the means. This is the reason why Hannah Arendt said, terror is constitutive of the totalitarian political body, just as legality is for the Republican political body. The whole picture is a totalitarian drift. For political philosophy, particularly according to the work of Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben, it is a matter of normalizing a state of exception in which human rights are suspended. The past presents freedom of movement. It is a safe bet that the nature of these spaces aimed at controlling the movements of citizens, which will be reinventing in the name of other emergencies. Ecology, health, terrorism, manufactured in the name of the state of exception. Let us recall the political criteria of totalitarianism, which cannot be reduced to a dictatorship, a despotism, or tyranny. Monopoly of the mass media and the police force, central management of the economy, persecution of opponents and of any criticism, system of surveillance of individuals, encouragement of denunciation, concentrationary logic orchestrated on terror, clean slate policy, moving ideology built on the divisions between good citizens and bad citizens, on the enemy, visible or invisible, and purity. The totalitarian system is sustained by an ideology. That means a delusion belief which has no longer any link with logical truth or with the reality of experience, and which constantly needs to renew itself in its content in order to maintain an illegitimate power. The key instrument for the establishment of totalitarian power is first of all the harassment of minds, which must become permeable to the ideology. The media propaganda must obtain the division of the collective, of the traditional clans, families, social classes, political clans, according to the paranoia cleavage between the good and the bad. Line of designation can evolve according to the communist ideology. Theocracy intervenes through the designation of the enemy. Here, at the beginning, the enemy is an awful virus that intends to disseminate the human species and against which we are at war. Then the enemies become the disobedient who don't want to respect the so-called sanitary measures imposed by the political state. Propaganda, often masked behind subtle manipulations, is for your own good, takes pleasure in creating collective traumatic shocks. For example, accounting of death repeated daily, which will then allow it to extend its control over the system and terrorize population, which under the effect of the paradoxical injunctions and the wear and tear will call the torturing power as a savior. Anywhere, for its greatest misfortune that this so-called savior is at the same time the persecutor. Totalitarianism is international in its organization, universal in its ideological aim, and planetary in its political aspirations. It pursues the experiment of total domination, said Anna Arendt. In front of this generalized violence and induced despair, the psychists are awakened. Many people fall into suicidal acts, perversions, or madness. Individuals who behave in a respectful way of the fundamental prohibitions can, in favor of a totalitarian ideology, regress, and in particular on a perverse mode. The deployment of the totalitarian system therefore leads to the occurrence of numerous abuses of power and sadistic acts committed by little chiefs who revel with themselves. And one wonders then how this good family man, usually so pleasant and known for so long, became capable of so many atrocities. In conclusion, Goebbels noted in his diary, in the Warsaw ghetto, there was a certain rise in typhus, but measures were taken not let them out of the ghetto. After all, Jews have always been carriers of contagious disease. They must either be herded into a ghetto and left on their own, or they must be eliminated. Otherwise, they will always contaminate the healthy population of civilized states. It's important to mention that we have already had to deal with the sanitary ideology of an epidemiological type in the not-so-distant past with the typhus epidemic, which the Nazis claimed to be fighting and eradicating. It is indeed the deployment of this hunt for the typhus epidemic that designates a category of the population as being carriers of it and treat them as epidemic propagating parasites. The typhus epidemic was spreading because all the conditions were there for it. Distribution of bedbug infested blankets, crowding in unsanitary ghettos, etc. In an article entitled The Germs of a Fascist International While Everyone is Claiming Victory and Never Again, Hannah Arendt on the still smothering ashes of the war immediately announces the dangers of tomorrow in the guise of an empty international, which would infiltrate the post-war institutions in the manner of an occult sect within the after-war institutions and may come back even through the creation of Europe. That's it. That is to say that at the very moment when European populations thought they had gotten rid of the awful days, the philosopher warns it could happen again and much worse. In the totalitarian system, the living is the enemy. The individual is reduced at best to a number. The language is corrupted so that individuals can no longer think about what happens to them. For example, the asymptomatic sick people. This expression means nothing. Or the addition of a new vocabulary in the media, no less than 60 new words or expressions. The goal is no longer alienation, but the annihilation of the human subject. And for that, it's necessary to break all spontaneity. Totalitarianism is by essence genocidal. It does not need the human anymore, or rather, it pretends to create him again from scratch. The new man to whom it's necessary to suppress the freedom to make reign the tyrannical and unhasty ideal of purity. Transhumanism, which is a modern form of the Nazi Superman, is the pure and simple negation of human rights. The term transhumanism was invented in the 1940 by Aldous Huxley's brother to replace the term eugenics. The apology of the powerful body, of the will of the power, of the transhumanized Superman supposes the elimination of the supposedly useless of the sick and suffering bodies. Totalitarian regimes always use science, or we should rather say scientism, to establish a pseudo-legitimacy for their existence and demand a kind of religious fervor towards this scientism. The current crisis is the reign of the god of mathematics. Hannah Arendt said that propaganda is no longer an objective problem about which people can have an opinion, but has become in their lives an element as real and intangible as the rules of arithmetic. However, I must remind you that it is impossible to apply mathematical, statistical, biological concepts to the human politic, moral, and spiritual experience. If we accept that mathematics, that statistics run our human existence, we are reduced to numbers, to positive, to negative, positive case, negative case, and we can therefore be eliminated without any remorse. The discipline that thinks about human political, moral, and spiritual experience is philosophy, especially moral and political philosophy and metaphysics. The human being is sacred. Human life is sacred. In other words, it's impossible to apply scientific concepts coming from the so-called hard science, which, it should be remembered, are science of dead matter, to the human political, moral, and spiritual experience. The scientific approach, carried by its limits, becomes inhuman and is then used to try to justify approaches that are in reality neither scientific nor human. Let us quote the writer Kessler, who testifies to the methods of recruitment of the totalitarian experience that he himself lived in this book, Darkness at Moon. There are only two conceptions of human morality, and there are at opposite poles. One is Christian and humanitarian, declaring the individual such and asserting that the rules of arithmetic should not apply to human units, which in our equation represents either zero or infinity. The other conception starts from the fundamental principle that a collective end justifies all means, and not only allows but requires that the individual be in any case subordinated and sacrificed to the community, which can dispose of him either as a guinea pig to be used in an experiment or as a lamb to be sacrificed. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Ariane. Dexter, do we have questions? I think we do. Anna, I have a question, or I have a couple of questions, if you allow me. Both of you seem to agree that this is not just happening, but this is something that other people have invented, and this is now a worldwide concerted effort going on. Is that correct? What kind of people do this? I know I've asked this question before, but how can anyone go beyond what we would consider empathy, for example, and humanity, and believe in sacrificing individuals for the greater good? What kind of people are we dealing with? Are we dealing with psychopaths who are still capable of understanding what they're doing and controlling what they're doing?
I think that a psychopath understands very well the difference between right and wrong, mm-hmm. but they have a spiritual problem of the conscience. The conscience is what makes us human, and they can tell the difference between right and wrong. They're not crazy at all, but their conscience doesn't feel the weight of the guilt that the rest of us would feel, those of us who are capable of feeling empathy. Over the years, sometimes psychopaths have commented on my videos and they have openly said that they feel superior to other people because they're not bothered uh-huh. by that empathy and sense of guilt.
So there is a certain megalomania involved in this. They think they're much better than anyone else, and that's why they can do whatever they want with individuals.
The grandiosity and the entitlement that they should get away with it.
Yeah. That is what criminals who commit very gruesome deeds usually have in common, don't they?
You know, the interesting thing, though, is that when the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, describes the narcissistic personality disorder and the antisocial personality disorder as the overt types, uh-huh. the obvious types, the criminals who get caught and go to jail. They don't describe in the scientific literature the covert types, who are very sophisticated and, in my opinion, far more dangerous because of how hidden they are and how far they can go in society because of that.
Does that mean that the those who are pulling the strings are no more dangerous than those who are helping them, the ones whose strings are being pulled?
So those would be the enablers.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about an abusive system, you can even look at a family unit or society in general, but any abusive system is formed of abusers and enablers. And it's actually the enablers that keep that system functioning.
Mm-hmm.
The abusers need the enablers to do that bidding for them.
I will speak in French. Tout le monde ne recherche pas le pouvoir.
I cannot. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was muted, so I couldn't translate. I'm going to translate what Rainer was asking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it seems that both of you, Ariane, il semble que toi et Meredith vous êtes d'accord. Ce que Rainer veut savoir. C'est qui sont ces gens, est-ce que ce sont des psychopathes, c'est à peu près les mêmes questions qu'il a posées la dernière fois. Qui sont ces gens-là? Et voilà. Meredith, si tu as quelque chose à rajouter, tu aurais oublié, mais c'est en gros, c'est ça.
C'est bon. tout le monde ne recherche pas le pouvoir. Les profils qui recherchent le pouvoir sont essentiellement les paranoïaques et les pervers. Ça, il faut que tu...
Not everybody is looking for power, but essentially paranoiac and pervert.
Ce sont des troubles narcissiques. On peut mettre la psychopathie, perversion, paranoïa. Ce sont des troubles narcissiques graves.
It is a narcissistic trouble, a serious one,
Ils n'ont pas, dans leur construction psychologique, développé l'altérité.
And they have not developed in their psychic development togetherness.
Maturity,
okay.
Maturity or
togetherness. Mm-hmm. How do we get out of this? Comment sortons-nous de là?
In my view, it is important for the people to understand what's going on, to see the whole picture. Is there any other way? Because to me, that is the only way to make people see what is really going on. And only if they can see and understand what is going on, can they stand up and fight this.
Pour moi, ce qui est important, c'est que les gens voient le grand tableau. Hein, c'est ce que dit Trainer. Il faudrait voir le grand tableau pour que les gens comprennent.
Anna Arendt disait que le totalitarisme s'arrête quand les masses cessent de croire.
So Anna Arendt said that totalitarianism stops when the masses stop to believe blindly, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's when enough people start to see the truth.
Mm-hmm.
S'il n'y a pas de participation de la société civile, il n'y a pas de totalitarisme.
If the society, the people in the society don't participate, there is no totalitarianism.
Yes,
but
that is...
Yeah, but for this they also have to know, and that's maybe why we see this intense efforts of, like, censorship right now, because it's becoming a little bit dangerous, like, you know, the amount of people speaking out now or meeting on the streets, and that's what you think also.
Yes. I think also that more and more censorship and the media that made so much work, that's really difficult for us to manage to give the truth. Yeah. So I think it's a main problem we have now.
Yeah. Donc c'est vraiment la censure qui est le principal problème actuellement.
Et les médias grand public, ils font un travail de sape énorme.
And the mainstream media is the main issue and the censorship.
Il y a une barrière psychologique pour les gens, c'est de penser que leurs gouvernants leur veulent du mal.
Well, there is a blockage because they have a really a difficult time to conceive that some other people wants to harm them.
I think one of the biggest challenges is the cognitive dissonance, because even if the censorship didn't exist to control the information, to control the reality, even if people had access to that information, it's so difficult for them to even face the truth in that state. And something really important that Ariane mentioned earlier was the deprivation of human rights and how human rights are suspended. And the trick that all abusers do and what keeps people in the abuse is that they want to destroy your self-worth. They have to flatten your self-worth. They have to make you believe that you are not worthy of your basic human rights. And what is at assault here, it's not just the vaccine, and it is compliance. They want to violate our consent. And that is going to be the theme that's going to continue in the next pandemic and the next crisis that they manufacture or take advantage of all the way to the Great Reset. So the self-worth is so important for the individual to rebuild. Otherwise, they're not going to believe that they're worthy of those basic human rights.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
I'm sorry, Dexter.
No, no, thank you, Raina. You have mentioned something very, very important, and that is, Ms. Miller, you were mentioning consent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we look at a Nuremberg Code, we look at a Helsinki Declaration, we look at natural law, whatever, it all comes down to consent. So for me, it seems to me that they are actually, this is definitely a psychological law, but that it's a psychological law with the main emphasis to actually get voluntary consent from the populace. And what it will then ultimately come to, and I can already foresee that this can be a possible defense when we actually pursue this further. And that is to say, no, we just gave them the information, and with that information, they've actually given consent. But from a psychological point of view, when it comes now to that consent, that was definitely granted on the basis of the psychological warfare that was conducted on the populace. Will you not agree?
That's correct. And that's what every abuser does in a relationship. They tell you without telling you what they're doing. So then they can say, well, I told you and you knew all along, because they don't accept any accountability for their actions. The more sophisticated, the more covert the abuser is, the more they need your voluntary consent. But as I think it was Virginie that mentioned earlier today, it's not real consent. Because when people are not provided with the true information, they don't realize deception is taking place. They're not giving real consent. That was a trick. That was a ruse to get them to consent to something that was a deception all along.
So obviously, the mass media is playing a massive role when it comes to getting people to a point to consent them, to put them in that mind space.
Yeah, so that's the whole thing, is the abuser's equation is problem, reaction, solution. And so this is a bit what Brian Garrison was talking about last weekend with the applied behavioral psychology, where they provoke, first there's a problem. So they either manufacture a problem or a crisis, or they take advantage of one that's already happening. And then they provoke your emotion, whether it's fear, for example, and then by provoking that emotion, they can almost predict what your behavioral response is going to be, so they can drive you to a predetermined solution. And the most sophisticated abusers will make you beg for that solution and think that it was your idea all along.
But that is, this basically brings me to follow the signs. Because when you listen to all of these talking heads, they will, and even the medical doctors like Dr. Fauci, one of the defendants, they will always repetitively actually mention follow the signs. And that's then to put the populace in a specific mindset to say, you can trust me. I know what I am doing and I will do no harm to you. But obviously that's not the case.
And that was one, if we take a look at that Yale study, that was one of the emotional manipulation tactics they used, is trust in science. And so when you hear Fauci say, I am science, and if you don't believe me, you don't believe in science. That those catchphrases, it's like a whole download of information that triggers an emotional reaction and then a behavioral response.
I had one question, just a very brief one. And Meredith, you mentioned something, an excellent presentation by both of you, by the way. It was very nice how it dovetailed together and really enhanced one another. But Meredith, you mentioned something about in the Stockholm Syndrome, the perceived life threat, and then you gave an example of people who were either fearing the virus or other people, and at the opposite end of that spectrum were people who were fearing tyranny. And that made me think that maybe none of us really, as much as we think we know what might be going on, none of us has escaped some of this psychological terrorism that has been going on across the globe. Is that a fair statement?
For sure. I will admit I've also been in this state periodically throughout the time that's gone on. And I think that we all have experienced moments of that. Perhaps some people spend more time in that state than others. And some of us are able to get back up into those higher states of consciousness because of working on healing our own traumas in our life. But otherwise, it's very difficult to get out of that state. And really, no one is completely immune to that. But the self-worth is really the greatest immunity to abuse and manipulation, because it really makes you question what people are trying to get you to do and what is their intention.
That's a great key. I'm sorry, you probably need to translate, but that's a great key, the self-worth. And that's where we need to maybe empower people. And that's one of the things I think we're doing by empowering them with knowledge and the self-worth, that they are worthy humans to have human rights.
I think a big part of the self-worth, how can people find self-worth, is setting boundaries. So then the knowledge is not going to change their self-worth. Knowing that they're human and that they have inalienable rights, the God-given rights from birthright to human rights, this means nothing to a person who's caught in that state. So the only way to start rebuilding self-worth is to evaluate what most matters to you, take inventory of your values, and then set boundaries to protect those. And every time you set a boundary, like no, and no is the complete sentence, and only manipulators keep pushing and pushing once you've said no, right? So when a person sets that boundary, they start rebuilding their self-worth naturally.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Ariane would like to talk, and for some reason she has been muted, so... if there is something that can be done so she can also answer. Oh, okay. Here you are. They were talking, I think it was Rainer or Dexter, I think it was Dexter that talked about the emphasis on consent. That's what you said, Dexter?
That's correct, yeah, from a psychological point of view. And I think for you, if you can bring it from a totalitarian point of view, that would be awesome. That would be great. Thank you.
Can you talk about, Ariane, can you talk, est-ce que tu peux parler du consentement du point de vue psychologique avec le totalitarisme?
En fait, le harceleur recherche la soumission de sa victime.
The harasser looks for submission of his victim.
Et pour cela, elle ne peut pas se mettre en opposition. C'est contre-productif pour lui.
So it cannot be in opposition. It's counterproductive for him.
Il doit amener à faire en sorte que la victime fasse quelque chose qu'elle n'aurait pas fait si elle n'avait pas été harcelée.
He must push the victim to do something that he will not have done if he wasn't harassed.
C'est pour ça qu'il y a manipulation.
Ordinarily. That's why there is manipulation.
Le syndrome de Stockholm, c'est un moment où la victime ne peut pas échapper à son harceleur.
The Stockholm syndrome is the time that the victim cannot escape to the harasser.
Elle est prise au piège.
The victim is trapped.
Et donc, il y a un mécanisme de survie.
Therefore, there is a mechanism of survival.
Où la victime va anticiper ce que veut son bourreau.
So therefore, the victim is going to anticipate what wants his perpetrator.
Pour essayer que
what the perpetrators want.
Pour essayer de survivre.
To try to survive.
Et donc, elle va se mettre dans le cerveau de son bourreau.
So it's like it's going to the victim is going to be in the brain, in the brain.
Et c'est à ce moment-là qu'elle va en même temps rencontrer la souffrance de son bourreau.
At the same time when the victim is going to meet the suffering of his perpetrator, encounter the suffering
of the perpetrator.
Et ensuite, comme
then,
le, pour nous, le mécanisme...
Can I ask a question, Ariane? Is it for this reason that sometimes we see people surpassing what is expected, for example, masks in the car, masks everywhere, even if it's not mandatory? It's for this reason?
Virginie, tu peux le dire en français?
Oui, oui. Il ne
je voulais dire que, est-ce que c'est... Oh, bah, pardon. est-ce que que l'on voit parfois des gens qui vont au-delà de ce qu'on leur demande, à savoir porter le masque dans la voiture, partout, même quand ils sont seuls. C'est pour cette raison, ils vont au-delà de ce que demande le bourreau. En fait.
C'est un mécanisme de survie. Si on plaît, si on plaît au bourreau, peut-être il va nous épargner.
It's a mechanism of survival. If we please the perpetrator, maybe we're going to be safe. We're going to be safe.
Et donc après, il y a un mécanisme. Nous effaçons toujours les événements désagréables que nous avons vécu.
And then there is another mechanism. We always erase, forget what was unpleasant.
Et donc, la victime ne garde plus que l'empathie pour son bourreau.
And therefore, the victim keeps only the empathy for her perpetrator.
Et c'est d'autant plus facile que le bourreau manie des discours paradoxaux.
And it's much easier, much more easier because the perpetrator uses paradoxical discourses.
C'est pour ton bien.
It's for your own good.
Je t'aime.
C'est I love you.
So what we have here, if we talk about a solution, we have to not just understand rationally what is going on, and that's probably what we have to do to show the whole picture so that people see what's going on. But it's not enough to see this rationally. We also need to overcome what one of you called, I think it was you, Meredith, spiritual bankruptcy. We have to understand that there's something out there that's worthwhile fighting for, either a loved one or spirituality or religion, whatever. But it takes not just rational understanding of what's going on, but it's also important to overcome this spiritual bankruptcy. That's a great term.
Yeah, and like you said...
I'm sorry. What Mayor said, it's not enough... Huh?
Pardon. Nous devons trouver donc une solution, non pas seulement comprendre les choses rationnellement, mais nous devons aussi comprendre l'aspect spirituel et voir au point où nous avons été. Finalement, nous avons négligé l'aspect spirituel. Hein? Brenner, you mentioned how sometimes people thought of their children or their grandchildren or their creator or something beyond themselves.
Exactly.
And that is often a very helpful motivation because what gets the person off the floor? You know, humanity is on the floor right now for the most part, and that is the victim in an abusive relationship. Nobody can lift that person up. You can pick them up and they're going to fall right back down. They have to find it within themselves. But like you said, that spark for them, what reignites their soul and their spirit after this kind of abuse is something beyond themselves that motivates them to get up because they don't believe they're worth it. But is there something else that's worth it?
That's very well put. That's easy to understand now. Thank you.
Je pense que ce qui est compliqué, c'est que quand on a des victimes de harcèlement, on doit couper le lien au harceleur, et ça n'est pas possible.
So what is complicated here, it's usually in a relationship with harassers, and a victim, usually the solution is to cut the bond with the harasser. But here it's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
Mais les gens peuvent le faire quand même un petit peu, déjà en coupant les médias.
But people can do it a little bit first by turn it off the media, the TV.
Donc, ce qui est très important, c'est de proposer, comme nous faisons, d'autres discours en nommant, comme l'a dit ma collègue, la relation d'abus, la transgression.
If I understand, okay. So what we need to do is name what you said, and it's name thing. And what else? Qu'est-ce que tu dis d'autre?
De nommer, de proposer d'autres discours qui mm-hmm. nomment la relation de transgression.
Mm-hmm.
So what we need is we need to hear other discourses that name things and offer other other ways.
Mm-hmm. Virginie.
I have a question on this point. It's about the philanthropic Bill Gates we heard at the beginning of the session. And you say, Dr. Bjorn, that paranoia profile is aware that he's army. And he has the intention of arming because there's no delusion construction. When Bill Gates says that he's sad because he is not successful in vaccinating all the world, what do you think? He knows that he is arming people by financing everything, for example?
C'est compliqué. Alors, parce que j'aimerais beaucoup expertiser Bill Gates, le récit, est-ce qu'il croit au récit qu'il a proposé? Si nous sommes dans ce genre de pathologie, il n'y a pas d'inscription de vrai et de faux. C'est-à-dire que nous sommes bien en deçà dans la construction psychologique de la capacité de distinguer le vrai et le faux. Donc d'avoir un discours et une compréhension, une capacité, même si ça a l'air rationnel.
On va couper ça en plusieurs choses. So you said complicated. You would like to talk about Bill Gates. Can you repeat just because I got confused? If you're in this kind of pathology, of it go beyond good and bad. That's what you said. Ça va au-delà du bien et du mal. Qu'est-ce que tu as dit? Rien.
Non, j'ai dit que dans la construction, si nous avons affaire par exemple, à une construction de type paranoïaque, il n'y a pas accès au vrai ou au faux, à la capacité de discerner le vrai et le faux, c'est-à-dire qu'en fait.
Okay. So if we're talking about paranoid profile, which is the case here, they don't have access. We don't have access to the notion of right and wrong. Is it that?
Et plus que bien et mal. Oui. C'est-à-dire que l'imaginaire est confondu avec la réalité.
Imagination is confused with a reality.
La personne dit quelque chose un jour et le lendemain autre chose, l'inverse.
The person thinks one thing one day and it will do the opposite next day.
Mais le rapport au monde reste un rapport de harcèlement et de persécution avec une intention de harceler. Mm-hmm.
But the connection with the world is still a connection of persecution.
Et donc, on a l'éternelle question entre la philosophie et le droit. Pour nous, l'éternelle question entre la psychologie et le droit, pour nous, les psys, on peut tout expliquer. Mais le droit doit poser des limites.
So we still have this dilemma between philosophy and right.
Psychology and right.
And
en psychologie, on peut tout expliquer.
In psychology, we can explain everything.
Mais ici, c'est des limites. Et
oui, les limites.
Et tous les profils harceleurs sont soit pervers, soit paranoïaques.
And all the perverse harassing profiles are pervert or paranoiac.
C'est-à-dire avec une difficulté, une impossibilité de respecter l'autre.
An incapacity to respect others, the others.
Une incapacité à contrôler ses pulsions.
An incapacity to control their urges, their pulsions, urges.
Une incapacité à réellement être capable de discerner le vrai du faux.
An incapacity to clearly define the wrong and the right.
Et une incapacité à distinguer le bien du mal.
The good and the bad. Evil or bad, or good.
Mm-hmm. I like to take solace or even courage in the recognition that it doesn't take 80% or 70% or even 50% of the people to turn this thing around. Rather, I tend to believe that only a few good men and women under these circumstances are capable of turning this thing around. You don't need the masses. The reason why I'm saying this is because the masses who seem to be under the influence of mass formation are not capable of any real activities. They can only react to what they're being told. We, on the other hand, are the ones, we who are in this group right now, and probably most of the people who are watching this, most of our jury, we have already asked questions. We have already come to the conclusion that there's something wrong here. That's why I think that it is not important to get the masses behind us, but only a few good men and women, maybe 5%, maybe 10%. Is that a correct assumption?
The critical mass, I think is what you're saying. What is that critical mass? And I think there's going to be some people that will never wake up. I think some people will take this to their graves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's actually okay, that we don't have to try to convert everyone or wake everybody up. In fact, that's even disrespectful to try to confront somebody who doesn't want to listen to what we're saying. But I do think you're right, but at a certain point, I don't know what the number is, that critical mass will create some kind of shift and also invite some kind of, you know, some kind of intervention from beyond, perhaps, that will assist us in this process.
Thank you.
En psychologie sociale, on a eu quand même beaucoup d'expérience de soumission à l'autorité, avec Milgram, avec la prison de Stanford. Au début, on est plutôt aux alentours de 1%.
So what you said, in social psychology, it's rather around 1%.
Avec l'expérience de Milgram ou la prison de Stanford, par exemple, sur la soumission à l'autorité.
Tu dis que 1% c'est suffisant pour faire basculer les choses?
Non, je dis que c'est 1% qui est capable de résister dans les expériences de psychologie.
So on top of it, it's 1% that is capable of resisting.
Avec les expériences connues de Milgram et de la prison de Stanford, par exemple.
Based on the Milgram experience.
More than that, because the party, the basis has already, they made up almost, gained almost 800,000 votes. And these are clearly like anti-measures people, and then there's much, much more anti-measures people who have never heard of this party, for instance, or like just didn't vote for them. So I think in Germany, at least, the situation has reached much more than those 1%.
Mm-hmm.
Distinguer le début de l'expérience et la suite. Les 1%, c'est le début de l'expérience de la soumission à l'autorité. En mars 2020, combien étions-nous?
Well, it's just at the beginning of the experience that was made on the submission of authority. At that point, they found out it was just 1% that could resist, you know? So it was based on the study,
mm-hmm.
Neil Graham study.
Mm-hmm.
But resistance is also infectious. Also, so.
Yeah.
More than the virus.
Good.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I don't want to cut anyone off. Anna or Dexter? I was thinking that...
I have some more questions.
I was thinking that was encouraging. So why not end on that note for today?
Yes. No further questions from you as well.
Well, thank you very much for all of you have done for us tonight. This was real encouragement, ultimately. Thank you for staying with us for so long. Thank you, Virginie. Thank you, Meredith. Thank you, Anna. Thank you, Ariane. Thank you, Vanna. Thank you, Judge Rui de Castro. And thank you, Dexter. And thank you, everyone, for staying with us, for listening, and hopefully standing up.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You, Reiner.
Thank you, Reiner.
We'll see you all tomorrow then.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Good evening. Summary of day 4 of the grand jury investigation of the Court of Public Opinion, February 2022. Several experts took yesterday the opportunity to talk about so-called vaccines. More precisely, Dr. Alexandra Henriot, Dr. Vanessa Smith-Kruger, Dr. Dylan McLeod, Dr. Shushad Bhakti, Dr. Mike Eden, Dr. Antonia Tagati, Professor Aaron Burkati, Dr. Werner Bergholz mentioned the following. The unprecedented adverse reaction numbers with these injections and increasing of illness in injected people. If Wuhan variant was extinct without a vaccine, why are they injecting people for something that is not around anymore? It was not by mistake that for 2 years the sole answer to COVID-19 has been repeatedly the vaccine. There was no assessment of epidemic dynamics. The injection campaigns have been followed by an increase of deaths from COVID-19. Spike protein not only is a hotspot for mutations, but also extremely toxic. The repeated boosting is destroying people's immunity system. No intramuscular vaccine can be effective against a respiratory virus. The lungs have their own immunity system. No mRNA vaccines were before used in humans. The Pfizer trial should have been declared invalid since they were full of manipulation and irregularities. There were also in the trial several adverse events which should have been the reason to stop them. Not only the spike protein, but also the lipids in the substance are highly toxic. The spike protein doesn't stay in the muscle, but spreads through the entire body and to the bloodstream. These injection effects, which are toxic by design, aren't mistake, but intentional. There is the high probability that the content is in the vials are different between them. The analysis of some vials show the presence of technological developed nano entities. Autopsies performed on dead people showed a high probability that they died from the effects of spike protein in the body. Then Meredith Miller and Arian Billeran talked about the mental health issues of people that comply to tyranny and how the cognitive dissonance and Stockholm syndrome to increased by confinement play a role in the euthanasic submission we have seen during the past 2 years. This was the summary of day four of the grand jury. Thank you.
Good evening, good morning, good day. Tonight's session of the grand jury model proceeding will deal with finances and economics. The question is why, of course. Well, Corona is a distraction, a diversionary tactic. With the help of Corona, people are brought into panic mode so that they will focus only on Corona and will not be able to see anything else. Well, what is this anything else? The other side, the Davos clique, or Mr. Global's megalomaniac desire to gain full control over humanity. One of the means to gain full control over the people are the measures, in particular, of course, the so-called vaccinations, which we looked into last night. Why is this being rolled out now? We know it's not about health. Why is this whole Corona scare being rolled out now? Well, that seems to have to do with the financial system being about to collapse after the other side has been looting and plundered it for decades, maybe longer. The financial system, it appears, is the U.S. dollar and the euro currency. Both are on the verge of collapsing. And that is because the people who are responsible for Corona have been responsible for looting and plundering and therefore bringing the financial system close to a collapse. Apart from the introduction of the digital passport, which is one major means of gaining full control over the people, there is the issue of digital currency. That's why even those of us who have never been interested in finance and economics should now take a closer look. After all, it's about pension funds being completely broke and healthcare systems being so expensive that only rich people can afford them. That's why it's justified to take a closer look into the finances, into the devastation that has been caused by those who now need Corona to divert our attention from this. We will start tonight with a hearing Patrick Wood, who will explain the basics, the geopolitical or historical backdrop of what we're dealing with. Patrick.
Okay, coming on here. Thank you. We got all the technology straightened out here. I'm going to share my screen with you, if that's okay.
Sure.
And hopefully it's going to work the first time. Here we go. All right. Hopefully everybody can see this just fine. I've got a lot of things to put into my presentation here to kind of kick this off today. I'm very pleased to be presenting this information with so many great colleagues. You all have given me new reading assignments. Your collective works will be next on my list, I'm afraid. I am Patrick Wood. I'm the editor and producer of Technocracy.News, a website that is dedicated to the critical analysis of economic affairs as it relates to technocracy. And I want to start out, we're asking a question, is capitalism in general on the world stage under fire? Is it being targeted for death? Well, here's a statement by a prominent member of the World Economic Forum. He's the chief executive officer of Salesforce, Marc Benioff. And he said on January 24 at the Davos meeting, capitalism as we have known it is dead. That's a bold statement. That was followed up in the same meeting by a presentation by Angela Merkel, and she said that capitalism is the worst of all possible economic systems. You can see the predisposition that exists within the World Economic Forum, at least, which is very closely tied to the United Nations, by the way, and all the topics surrounding sustainable development. We're going to go through some of those, and I'm explaining to you. This is kind of a difficult thing to understand, I suppose, lots of information, but I just want to say it just may have been a coincidence that only 4 days later, January 30th, 2020, the World Health Organization stepped up and declared a public health emergency of international concern. That's when the pandemic really started to spin up. And of course, it was a few weeks after that that they actually declared a pandemic condition. It was a multi-step process to get to that point of total declaration, but this is where it started. It would appear that the people at the World Economic Forum welcomed this crisis, this emergency, because if capitalism were not altogether dead at that point, it was about to be, the rest of the act of murder was about to be taking place here. I want to take you back in history to 1974, where, to use a phrase that Klaus Schwab likes to use, we need to reimagine our world. Well, globalization was reimagined in 1974. This was an important sea change I think many people missed, but one of the original founding members and very prominent members of the Trilateral Commission, Professor Richard Gardner, wrote an article that appeared in Foreign Affairs called The Hard Road to World Order. And in it, he wrote this, in short, the house of world order will have to be built from the bottom up rather than from the top down. It will look like a great booming, buzzing confusion. We can say amen to that today. But an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned frontal assault. Now, I want to say that I'm not going to go into any detail on this. You'll have to read some of my books or others, whatever, to pick up what were those frontal assaults that occurred before 1970, for instance. Well, they didn't work, whatever they were. We could talk about it. I'm not going to take time now. Those old-fashioned frontal assaults were put on the shelf for a period of time to execute a strategy and a policy of an end run around national sovereignty. And it wasn't just for America. It was for all the nations of the world. This plan has been underway ever since that time when he wrote this, and this is a major change because they love the frontal assault approach, and they just realized it wasn't getting them anywhere. We have returned back to that old era now where the frontal assault is preferred over the end-run assault, and we see this in our face now everywhere you look. So I want to talk about the genesis of modern globalization just a minute. Even if this sounds a little bit redundant or boring, you'll get it as we go along. And I've only got 20 minutes, and I'll be on it. 1970, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the brilliant political scientist at Columbia University, brilliant, I say, didn't agree with the word he said, but he's brilliant. He published a book, Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. I'll mention not the word technocratic after this, but rather technocratic. But this was the book that set the stage for modern globalization. In 1973, the Trilateral Commission was founded by David Rockefeller and Zbigniew Brzezinski to create what they called at the time a new international economic order. This was all over their literature, not my phrase. In 1974, less than a year, actually it was only 6 months after the Trilateral Commission was founded, the United Nations steps up with General Resolution 3201, you can look it up if you want, called the Declaration on the Establishment of a New International Economic Order, exactly the same phrase. Now, we know historically that the Rockefeller family and the United Nations have had a very cozy relationship, and it was not surprising that that the United Nations would be the chosen tool to provide the contagion to take this doctrine around the world to all the other nations of the planet. So in 1978, just kind of have to bring this in passing through, China was brought onto the world economic stage by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who at the time, by then, was the national security advisor to President James Earl Carter. Carter also and his vice president, Walter Mondale, were members of the same commission. Their cabinet, all but one member of the Carter's cabinet, were members of the Trilateral Commission. They drug the whole lot of them into our government structure at that time. But it was Zbigniew Brzezinski who brought Chairman Deng into the world stage again on behalf of China. Then we go into the maturing of modern globalization. 1987, Trilateral Commission member Gro Harlem Brundtland from Norway published a book called Our Common Future. It was part of the final result of the so-called Brundtland Commission that the United Nations has sponsored. And she was the one since then who has been hailed for the creation of the Sustainable Development Doctrine that is being pushed actually ever since then to the world through the United Nations. So in 1992, when the United Nations met in Rio de Janeiro as the so-called First Earth Summit, the Sustainable Development Doctrine was adopted as Agenda 21. That's what it was called. And you see these different synonyms coming in as we kind of go through here. Sustainable development is equivocal to Agenda 21, and there's some other phrases too. In the year 2000, the United Nations met in New York to create 8 millennium goals, they called them, for sustainable development. In other words, how to implement sustainable development. That was a 15-year term that they were given. So naturally, in 2015, another meeting was held in Addis Ababa to create the 2030 agenda, which would rule for the next 30 years, which takes us to the year 2030 from 2015. And they created a 17 set of points of sustainable development goals. Not going to go into what all those goals are. They're easily discovered on the internet, and you can go find out what they are. Then the next person to appear on the stage in the same year, 2015, was a lady by the name of Christiana Figueres, who at the time was heading up the Paris Climate Change Agreement. That made a big splash back in those days. And she was the one that drove the whole process. She was very energetic, I have to say. She was a master organizer. And she brought the nations of the world together to create the Global Paris Climate Accord. At the time, her title was Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. I don't know how you would fit that on a business card, but that was quite a title. She gave a press conference in 2015, and here what she said, and here is the threat to kill capitalism. This is important to establish motive and also things like threats. She said, this was a press conference, a verbal press conference. It was transcribed. She said, this is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. Now, these are very pointed words. There's no way to read these except that they had an intention, they had a motive, and they declared what that was. They didn't, of course, give what the timetable was, but they had a timetable as well. I'm no criminal lawyer, but if I was, I would be highly suspicious of this whole statement that they have just declared that there's criminal intent here to kill. They got motive, they got intention, they have a timetable. Next question is, do they have the ability to do it? And of course, we kind of know now, it's fait accompli, they did have the ability to do it, and they are doing it now. So the 2030 agenda document that was produced at that time, in paragraph 28, I just mentioned this in passing because this reinforces what she was saying. It said, we commit to making fundamental changes in the way that our societies produce and consume goods and services. This was a sea change for the economic system. Nobody really understood at the time, I don't think, what that was, but sustainable development was at the heart of it. And you will remember, thinking back, that for all of the emergencies we've had, for instance, global warming and climate change alarmism, et cetera, they have only offered one possible solution to the whole, whatever it was, the whole thing presenting the world, and that is sustainable development. It's always, there's never a plan B. It's always, well, we have this big problem. We have global warming. We have a pandemic. So what we need is sustainable development. that ought to be a tell right there that something's wrong with this picture, because intelligent men and women will always discuss things through until there's option A, B, and C at least, and maybe more, and then those are debated. So I want to just run through just for a second, what is sustainable development so that you can have some idea of what's going on here. The claim generally, I'm summarizing, I mean, thousands of pages of documents, I'm sure at the United Nations, but the claim is made that non-renewable resources must be terminated because after all, they're going to run out anyway, so we might as well just let them run out early. While newly discovered renewable resources must be managed and allocated to society. So this is, again, a huge change in thinking about what the economic system is. And you'll see some distinctives on the left column and right column in my table. First, the sustainable development column, which I argue in my books is actually warmed over technocracy from the 20th century. Sustainable development and or technocracy, if you use either one interchangeably, proposes the scientific management of resources and consumption, whereas capitalism and free market economics posits a price-based free market economy determined by supply and demand. This has been the way the world has run, by the way, throughout its entire history. There's never been anything else. There have been variations of it, but it's always the same. Secondly, fintech. Fintech, that's financial technologies contracted, is an underlying financial system that the United Nations has declared is the financial system for sustainable development. That includes blockchain, digital currencies, total surveillance, and a bunch of other things as well. Capitalism, on the other hand, is a currency-based, or depends on currency-based capital. And that is the underlying financial system that we have today and have had for centuries. Under sustainable development, there's no private property provided for whatsoever. Resources are to be held. That is, all resources of the world are to be held in a global common trust for the use of the world through those companies that would be chosen to make goods and services to deliver to us consumers. Capitalism, on the other hand, provides for ownership and the use of private property. That is a fundamental right in a capitalistic system, to own property. In fact, the ability to own property has been argued by many, many economists over the ages that is the singular most important factor in economic development throughout the world. Lastly, under sustainable development, there's no privacy allowed. Of course, in capitalism, free market economics, privacy is a fundamental right and is actually necessary for the proper functioning of capitalism. There's a number of reasons for that. I won't go into them right now, but I just want you to get a sense of some of the differences between capitalism, free market economics, and what sustainable development is. Now, having said that, I want to just clearly make the point that sustainable development, which I will argue is technocracy from even back as far as the 1930s, is 100% incompatible with free market economics and capitalism. When I say incompatible, I mean it's like matter and antimatter. It's like oil and water. They do not mix. They never will mix because they're otherworldly to each other. It's like somebody from Mars coming to Earth wanting to live and vice versa. It's not going to happen. When they collide in economic space, economic gangrene sets in. There are so many examples of this. And again, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into them. You can discover them pretty easily by yourself, where you see, for instance, the Green New Deal, big thing in the world. We have it in America here. The Green New Deal, whenever that hits traditional concepts of capitalism or free market economics, that's when the gangrene sets in and things start to rot. Unfortunately for these usurpers of this new system, capitalism just will not die a natural death. They would like it to die a natural death. This was the case back in 1932 when technocracy was originally designed. The Great Depression is a horrible time, and the group of scientists that created it at Columbia University were certain that capitalism was dead and that they and they alone could come to the rescue and design a brand new economic system from scratch that would be a scientifically operated system. In any case, because capitalism just would not die a natural death, then we have the result like this. Signs like this started appearing around the world, kill capitalism before it kills the planet. This has been a masterful propaganda hit job that didn't just stop with Mark Benoit at the World Economic Forum, but it was spread out to all of the alarmist community, whatever, around the world, and you started to see, yep, we certainly need to kill capitalism. It needs to die an untimely death. So what are some of the ways to kill capitalism, to destroy it in free market economics? I listed, nine things here. There may be a couple of more. But you will recognize these as being really kind of the hinge pins for our economic system in the world to work. And I hope at the same time that you're going to see that all of these areas, every single one, has been corrupted to some extent, some more than others perhaps. But here's the first one: withdraw energy from the economic system. All economic activity requires energy inputs. That's a given. I mean, that's so intuitive, hardly even have to state it. But without gasoline, your car doesn't run. Without energy, the economy doesn't work. So if you withdraw energy, like for instance, hey, let's kill coal, let's kill oil, let's kill natural gas, let's kill everything else except for windmills and solar panels and whatever to energize the world, you see, they're withdrawing energy from the system. Here's the next one: withdraw resources, create shortages of commodities and materials. Heaven knows, we're living this right now. We have huge shortages ahead. Not because there are real shortages, I might add. These are manufactured or contrived shortages that are being blamed for our economic woes, but they're being withdrawn. And for instance, the price of lumber is as high as it's ever been, short of a building season in the spring, at least in the north. Well, are there any less trees in the forests or in North America or Canada? Well, no, there's plenty of trees. There's lots of timber, but they tell us there's a shortage. Okay, here's the next one: corrupt the supply chain. Well, commodities and products have to be transported, even if it's just on a local basis or international, doesn't matter. There needs to be transportation. That supply chain has been a concept, an age-old concept, but it's been changed according to modern globalization to where supply chain now is a very intricate, delicate affair. And, it's, of course, even though it's being curtailed right now, it does not mean that it's going to die and forever be curtailed. For the time being, however, the supply chain is being totally disrupted, and there's absolutely no doubt. Here's the next one: withdraw labor. All economic activity requires labor inputs. So what have we had in the last 2 years here? We've had a massive withdrawal of people from the labor force. We've had a massive drop in productivity of the people that remained in the labor force. And many people are still hiding out in their homes, scared to death to come out and go back to work, in some cases because they get too much money from the government as it is. Then the next one I put up here is withdrawing finance and capital. All economic activity requires flows of money. So you've seen World Economic Forum policies and policies from the United Nations that talk about environmental investing and this concept of ESG, where if your company doesn't invest in the things we say it should invest in, then you are going to be blacklisted and blackballed, where you will not be able to get loans from the bank for the projects you want to do. In other words, you have to adopt our conditionalities before we'll give you another dime. We've seen this run rampant in the last 2 years as well. The next one is limit consumption. Of course, it's kind of an oxymoron even to say that economic output must be consumed, but it must be. Somebody has to be out there ultimately to buy the goods and services that are being produced. So is consumption being limited today? Yes, it is. And you say, well, why? Because the middle class, at least in our country, and I think the rest of the world will pretty much attest to this, the middle class has been so decimated that their consumption has been greatly curtailed. I read a story just the other day, I think in America, it says now that 67% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. They don't have enough even for an emergency to come up. Next is kind of an oblique one, but limit innovation. Anytime innovation is limited, products are not created. In other words, a healthy economy requires continuous innovation of products and services. And is innovation being limited in today's world? Absolutely positively. I just talked to somebody here in the southwest region of the United States that has a new idea for energy production. It's a unique, I think it's probably a very unique idea. I won't say what it's based on, but they're excited. They're gathering investors right now to put into this project to see if they can create an energy company that will produce energy in a different way than is being produced now. These people are scared for their life because they know that the cartels are going to come after them. The energy cartels are going to come after them, shut them up. The worst thing for the whole global picture now is that if there was free energy or very inexpensive energy in the world, of course, which would drive economic activity, they'd be out of business. So they simply can't let it happen. Next is to create a cataclysmic event. Frightened people don't produce, spend, or consume. It's a perfect storm. I remember when there was a huge earthquake up in the Bay Area in California back in, I think it was in 1989, I believe, or early 90. That was so severe, bridges were collapsing, the Bay Bridge and collapsed, and it was a horrible thing. Lots of buildings collapsed and stuff. I can guarantee you, I was living at the time, there was no business activity took place for 6 months in that area, not anything. People wouldn't buy, they wouldn't sell, they didn't want to come out, they didn't want to answer the phone, the printers weren't printing, the salesmen weren't selling. It was a horrible time. But cataclysmic events are infamous for frightening people into a state of just catatonic shock where they cannot and will not budge to move forward on anything. The last thing that is, again, sort of oblique, but I know the economist-minded people will understand this for sure, create a system of malinvestment and disinvestment. That is, trick people into investing in the wrong things that are not, central to keeping the current system going. And so investing in counterproductive areas now, especially because the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, is legendary. They're investing in windmills instead of, we got other problems in the world right now. Besides, just worrying about how to get a stand of windmills up out the ocean, which environmentalists now are freaking out over because it started to kill all the fish out there too, and the birds if the things are on land. So malinvestment and disinvestment at this point is robbing the traditional economy of its natural flow of capital. So those are ways to destroy capitalism. I want to just say, in my opinion, every one of these has been on the table and has been purposely attacked. Now, and I'm not going to back that statement up right now, but you can think about it. Just a thought to put into your mind. So let's go now to Klaus Schwab, the founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, of course. You all have heard this phrase before. The pandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world. We've heard this a jillion times in the media. Pretty certain that most people read it and they go, oh, I don't like that, but they don't know why. They don't know what he's saying, and they don't really understand why they don't like it. I'm glad at least they decide they don't like it. And, of course, another phrase that has come out of the World Economic Forum is by 2030, you will own nothing and be happy. Nobody asked the question about this either, but I do. So if something exists in time and space, whether it be a car or some other product or machine or something, if something exists in time and space, somebody has to own it. When they say, you will own nothing and be happy, well, somebody has to own all that stuff. The question is who? And, of course, they talk about pay-per-view. If you want something, you can rent it, you can lease it, whatever, but we'll own it. We will let you use it on an as-needed basis as you pay the fees. Then we have, of course, they're talking about the Great Reset and the concept of Build Back Better. I want to just bring this up as a subtlety. I don't think it's too subtle, actually. But the Great Reset implies starting over from zero. when you, for instance, when you reset your clock or you reset a counter, it goes back to zero. And then you reach whatever it was you're doing, you reset and you move forward again. This is underscored by the phrase build back better. Building back better implies that whatever you're going to build back from is now reduced to ashes. I don't know why more people don't just grasp onto this, but, you know, if heaven forbid that your house burned down, it's a tragic event when that happens. You lose everything, your pictures, your memorabilia and all. And when your house burns down, you're depressed for a year, you finally get your insurance settlement, living wherever, and it's rental or something for a period of time. And at the end of the, when you get your settlement, you think, well, we're gonna build a new house. You tell your wife, honey, we're going to build a new house. But be of good cheer, because this time we're going to build back better. That's what people say. When hope returns, we're going to build back better. So the whole idea, the whole mindset of the World Economic Forum that has been pushing propaganda to the world now for these last 2 years especially, is giving us a clear signal, as Benoit said in the beginning of this presentation, capitalism is dead. Klaus Schwab is saying exactly the same thing. We need to have a great reset. We need to reimagine everything that we do. I don't know how you imagine the world and then make it so. It makes no sense. But saying on the heels of that, that you're going to build back better on whatever got burned to the ground, is a very serious, in my mind anyway, very serious tell that these people intend for the destruction of the current economic system to be replaced with the other one, that is sustainable development, which I do believe is technocracy. So having said that, let me just give you a very, very quick, the quickest possible definition of what technocracy is. This is from the Technocrat magazine in 1938. Their declaration. They said, technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population. That was their scientific analysis at the time. They went on to say in the same article, there will be no place for politics, politicians, finance, or financiers. This will be a direct control over all economic activity. There will be no need for discussion because they believe their positions are so right, they can just dictate them to all humanity and humanity will follow. And then it goes on to say, technocracy will distribute by means of a certificate of distribution available to every citizen from birth to death. Now we can see hints of this in today's discussion on sustainable development and what the United Nations and the World Economic Forum is doing. This is exactly what they're intending to do, distribute by means of a certificate of distribution given to every citizen from birth to death. So technocracy, I want to reiterate, is the only alternative economic system in the history of the world. I studied this. I've sifted some documents and, you know, places where I could look, libraries, talk to people, whatever, historians. There is no other economic system, even though Angela Merkel, for instance, said at Davos in 2020 that there are many different economic systems that the world has experienced. She's wrong. There is no other economic system that's been designed from scratch except for technocracy, and as highly documented, heavily documented at Columbia University in 1932 and onwards from there. Actually, it goes backwards before that, but it got crystallized in 1932. So technocracy has morphed into the doctrine of sustainable development. There's many other synonyms now that cover it. There's the Green New Deal. There's the green economy. There's stakeholder capitalism. There's smart growth. There's Agenda 21, 2030 Agenda, et cetera. They're all referring to the same thing, an economic system based on resource management allocation where they control and or own all of the resources. And the people of the world own basically nothing. And that's why Klaus Schwab can say, and I'm certain of it, why he can say, you will own nothing and be happy. Of course, maybe he's just talking to his colleagues. I don't know. But if somebody's going to own it, somebody's going to be very happy. Back in the 1930s, this was the cartoonist view of technocracy. I want you just leave, I want to leave you with this last picture, that this is what journalists and society at the time, you know, cartoons reflect what's going on in people's minds. A good cartoonist can do that. This is how they pictured technocracy, that they were dealing with it back in that day. They rejected it, thank goodness, at the time. But they understood what technocracy would do. And I don't care what you call it today. You can call it man in the moon for all I care. It's a resource-based economic system, scientifically managed, including the people in the world scientifically managed with the science of social engineering. All of this stuff they saw would end in total destruction for society. That's where we are today. This is not a benevolent, benign economic system that's going to solve the problems of the world. We will come eventually to the same conclusion that they came in the 1930s with this cartoon. This is what it's going to look like if we let it proceed. And having said that, I don't know if I'm close to my 20 minutes, but I give up and I concede and pass the baton to the next speaker.
Thank you, Patrick. This is both impressive and shocking, but that picture that you're showing, this final picture, I think that says it all. They always say that a picture says more than 1,000 words, and this time it really does. It should scare all of us. We can, at this point, go into the questioning round, because our next guest should have been Edward Dowd, who will not be able to join us tonight. He will probably be able to join us at a later time. Ed Dowd was supposed to explain to us what's happening on Wall Street with two particular shares, the Moderna shares and the Pfizer shares. Both of them are under enormous pressure. So there we have, on the one hand, healthcare, which Moderna and Pfizer stand for, and the financial system. Why are these shares under pressure? Well, it's because, as we have learned yesterday, in yesterday's session of the grand jury investigation, that the Pfizer trials, for example, are just happen to be a huge fraud. And this is coming out. This is being exposed right now. That's why these shares are under pressure. Ed Dowd will, at a later time, explain why this has the capacity of bringing down not just the pharmaceutical industry, but the entire market, the entire financial industry. We'll take a look at that later. But for the time being, before we go into the questioning round, let us take a look to clarify this a bit more at a very short video that was filmed by Project Veritas with a hidden camera. It's a interview. It's an interview with an FDA executive by the name of Chris Cole. It's only 2 minutes long.
Biden wants to inoculate as many people as possible. So you have to get an annual shot. I mean, it hasn't been formally announced yet. They don't want to, rile everyone up. The drug companies, the food companies, the vaccine companies, they pay us hundreds of millions of dollars a year to hire and keep the reviewers to approve their products. If they can get every person required at an annual vaccine, that is a recurring return of money going into their company.
So how do you know it's already getting approved?
Well, they're not going to, just from everything I've heard, they're not going to not approve this. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be a gradual thing. Schools are going to mandate it.
Why do they need the third one?
For the same reason that you or I would need the third one. So the three will bolster your system, and then there will be an annual, eventually an annual, just like the flu shot.
For the toddlers?
Well, for everyone.
Okay, so the toddlers too then. We'll have to get
probably.
Okay.
I don't completely agree with their the process.
What do you mean you don't agree with the process?
Well, I mean they don't have all the tests aren't there. So I agree with the thing that it is important to inoculate them. But you can't provide the parent as much assurity as you normally want to. It's an EUA for all all age groups, all designations, and then you have to get approved by specific age groups based on the study.
Do you think that's really an emergency for the toddlers?
Well, they're all approved under an emergency. The efficacy data doesn't have to be as high. The standard is on emergency use authorization is that it does more benefit than harm.
I thought their cases weren't that high for 6 months to a 4-year-old.
They're not, but it's because it's related to COVID, it's under that approval process.
So what does this tell us? There is a parallel that can be drawn between what is happening now and what happened 12 years ago when we had the Lehman crisis, the housing crisis that turned into a world economic crisis. Back then, the banking or financial industry, aptly named financial mafia, created worthless loans. Now, why would they do that? Loans that were given to people who would never be able to repay them for purchasing houses, which turned out to be ghost towns because nobody needed them. They didn't want them to be repaid. The only thing they were interested in is creating these loans, which they then turned into securities, which were then sold to European banks. Some speak of stupid German money. Many German banks were involved. And they sold these securities, which were allegedly safe and a sound investment, to the little old ladies who thought that this would give them additional income for their old age. Why did this work back then? It worked because there was a trusted third party, a party that rubber-stamped these securities, saying this is great, this is a sound investment. The rating agencies. What's happening now? We have these vaccines, which, as we have learned, don't work and are extremely dangerous. How did this work? Well, again, there's a trusted third party. Who is it this time? It's the FDA. What are they doing? They're getting paid by the pharmaceutical industry, by the very people, by the very companies that they're supposed to oversee and to protect us from if something goes wrong. That's why we're showing this video. Go ahead and ask your questions. I do have one or a couple of more, but I would like you to get started. You're muted, Dexter.
Thank you very much, Rainer. Thank you very much, Mr. Patrick Wood, for your excellent presentation. From your presentation, from your evidence that you've just presented, it is now clear and the jury can completely understand that we are now confronted, that is, humanity is confronted with two different paradigm mindsets. The one is sustainable development, technocracy, and the other one is when it comes to capitalism itself. So thank you for clarifying that. What I would like to find out from you, sir, is that it is also common cause, and I believe that a lot of the members of the jury are well familiar with the World Economic Forum Fourth Industrial Revolution, because that is something that is also on the forefront, and I would like you to explain to the members of the jury when it comes to the Fourth Industrial Revolution, how does that tie in with COVID-19?
Well, this is the frontal assault, in my opinion, that has been, well, let me back up just a second and say, going back for the last 20 years, we can identify false starts to a total frontal assault. There have been times when it looked like somebody's trying to punch through and really get something started. Global warming is a good case in point, by the way. They ran out of steam on that whole thing because everybody figured, nothing happening here, move on. And so the same crowd that was pumping climate alarmism jumped over onto the COVID-19 track. Same universities, same crack computer models. same type of analysis that was used to predict the world is going to end soon and we're all going to die sort of thing. So we've seen the frontal assault was trying to get out for, I think, probably, you know, maybe 10, 15 years at least, and 2007 through 9 was a perfect example of that. But for one reason or another, capitalism dies hard, for one, and finally they got enough traction to pull it off, I believe, in spades in 2020. I'm not sure that COVID-19 or the vaccines that we're looking at right now, in one sense, those are just props. They're the means to the end. We could have had something else. If they had been successful with global warming to get the whole world stumped up to go into sustainable development, they would have stuck with it. But it wasn't working for them. They needed something else that was more dramatic. One thing that global warming didn't have was dead bodies lying in the street. There weren't any. Polar bears, they said, were dying, but then we found out that they're doing fine. There are plenty of polar bears in the North Pole. But with COVID-19 now, you have bodies lying in the street or lying in the hospital, in the morgue, whatever, and people, you know people that have died, and they, oh my gosh, it really is true, we're all going to die. And that allowed them to throw everything against the wall, all the mud against the wall to stick. And it stuck. They panicked the whole world. And it was a different type of a panic this time. And people have asked, well, how can the whole world panic at the same time? It was the United Nations. The United Nations had been around all of those countries before in the world and had them sign memorandums that would commit them to doing certain things if the World Health Organization declared an emergency. So when this emergency hit, the World Health Organization and the United Nations at large sent out the memos to all the countries in the world. Remember when you signed this back here? This is what you need to do now. You need to follow what we say. And they go, oh my gosh, it's a pandemic. And they got scared, you know? And so all of a sudden these policies start rippling through the world like a wildfire. And all of a sudden, everything shuts down, just shuts down. So it's not to say that the virus thing is important. The vaccine is totally important, totally important. But I just want to point out the big picture, it could have been anything that would have taken them to their end. That's all they care about is getting to the finish line. The finish line is inventing, getting sustainable development in and capitalism out, so that they can own and control all the resources in the world, however they can do that.
Thank you very much for clarifying that. As a follow-up, one can then say, based on the evidence that you've just given, there is a direct correlation between the 14th Industrial Revolution and then ultimately now COVID-19. And you've
yes.
made it very clear yes. as well, where you said that this is basically just a means to an end. They had a lot of other quivers, or arrows in the quiver itself, in the quiver, but they ultimately decided this is the one that they will basically then shoot. So it all comes down to what you've actually also presented, and this is general knowledge as well. Also, it is a common course fact, and I am going to read it once more. And this is what Mr. Klaus Schwab has actually said, because this is in line to the evidence that you've just presented, that a pandemic represents a rare but narrow window of opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world. So by just reading that, for me, it is a clear indication that yes, this is, and there is actually a clear direct correlation between the 4th Industrial Revolution and then ultimately COVID-19. Thank you, sir.
Yes.
Would you like to comment on what I've said?
Well, I would say that If I went all the way back to Zbigniew Brzezinski's book in 1970 called Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Tectonic Era, he was looking forward to that fourth industrial revolution. That's where he was. That was his vision. He saw, in other words, he saw through the over the valley to the mountaintop on the other side. And this is what we're experiencing today. I think many authors and people have commented on this maybe over the years. It wasn't put together very well, but the fourth industrial revolution is the scientification of the planet. basically, the science, and that's a new word. I don't know if I just coined it. The scientification of the whole planet, where science runs and rules everything, data runs and rules everything, and the opinions of people and the political systems that we create to, you know, moderate our societies are meaningless, foolish, ignorant, whatever you want to call it, that's in their mind, and that they want to take direct control and tell everybody what they should do. That's the fourth industrial revolution, and Klaus Schwab is pretty clear about that.
Thank you very much for basically just answering or basically just reflecting on what I've just said. What I want to get to and once more, just by reminding the jury, the audience, that we are talking about natural law, and from your presentation, I will say there is now clear evidence from what you have presented that whatever systems they want to put in place, technocracy, it all comes against natural law. And natural law, what we basically say, is the right where you basically have autonomy over your own body, the right to make certain decisions, and from the ways to destroy capitalism, the nine ways that you've mentioned, for me, there is a clear indication as well, it is in direct conflict with natural law. Would you like to comment on that, sir?
You're absolutely right. Everything that has to do with what we're talking about today is an affront to natural law. Totally. It's not just an affront. That's not even adequate word to use, an affront. It's death. It's death to natural law. And this has been, I've demonstrated this in my books multiple times, in both of my books on technocracy recently, Technocracy Rising and The Hard Road to World Order. This is their attitude, that they have a better way, that they have such a certain way according to science that there's no need even to discuss it. This is the height of egotism. It's the height of, I want to use the word, you know, pathological, but when somebody can honestly believe that they're so right that you don't have any other choice but to obey them, that goes way over the top. And this is what this whole crowd is doing at this point. When somebody like Mark Benoit stands up and says capitalism is dead, he runs a single company. Who is he to declare to the whole world that capitalism is dead? And don't get me wrong, capitalism has problems, only because of the bad actors in it, I might add, but it has problems. The problems need to be corrected. That could be done. But that's not what they're ever going to even try to do. They want this new system for the express purpose of grabbing the resources of the world and taking them out of our hands and putting them into their hands, to where we will then be kind of like in a neo-feudalistic society where a few own everything and the rest of us just kind of squat on the back 40 and raise a few pigs and some corn and whatever and hope that we don't get thrown off. This is not the world that we, the people, voted for. This is not the world they asked us about before they just did it. And now they're telling us it's so wonderful, benevolent, and benign that we should just follow them like the Pied Piper, you know, blows his whistle and you know, all the, well, the rats and children, I guess, alike, follow him into destruction. We see through this now. This is a massive gaslighting operation that's been taking place for decades. We're starting to see through this. People are starting to see through this. This is not pro-humanity. It's not pro-human. It's not pro-human dignity. It is crushing to the human spirit. That just makes it, just by that alone, makes it so wrong. It doesn't matter what policies they bring to us. Anybody that comes to us with that kind of an attitude is off base immediately, and there's solutions along with them.
Thank you. So one can actually also then tie in with a fintech. Because, like, based on your evidence, I mean, we're talking about blockchain, digital currency, and then total surveillance. So obviously, all of that, in a sense, is then specifically when it comes to total surveillance, it comes against your human dignity. Will you agree with that?
It does. People have, you know, we talk about private property. People have, in the West, the right to own private property. It's been seriously degraded in the last 20 years, but that's made the economic system great, I have to say. But when you, that's not the property that they're talking about, totally. It's part of it. But you have the next level of property is your own person, your own body. So the question immediately comes up, you're claiming your body belongs to you. That doesn't go with their philosophy. Their philosophy says, no, your body belongs to us. We're pretty sure we want it, and we're going to get it one way or another. Then beyond that, what's the next level of probing that they can do? Well, it's what's up here in your mind. We want what's in your mind, too. We want to take away your ability to think and to reason and to come to your own critical analysis of some issue, whatever, for your sake, for your own body. This goes so much further than just what you think of private property, like a car you own or maybe property or you own a factory, something like that. Getting down to the bottom line is the ultimate loss of human dignity is what's in your mind, and they want that. They want to fill your mind full of what they want to believe and how they want to rewire your mind into thinking the way they want you to think. This is just evil in my opinion. Nobody has the right to do that to another person, another human being on earth. I don't care who you are. You just don't have that right. And there are criminals. You could say, well, what about a criminal? Well, no, you still don't have the right to do that. There's other ways to deal with it. Not to play 1984 with them and say, how many fingers am I holding up, Winston, or whatever, you know.
Thank you very much, Ms. Booth. No further questions for me.
Patrick, am I getting this right? Both Corona and global warming are simply false alarm tools to bring the population into panic mode so that they will ultimately do as they are told.
Yes. Let me temper that, though, by saying that there are other objectives to the messenger RNA shots. We'll talk about that, I think, next week. A very important part of this, too, is the, you know, why messenger RNA into the arms of the human race at this point in history. I think there's a very important story there that plays into this. I'll just say it this way. Technocracy is to the restructuring of society at large, as transhumanism is to the people who live in that society. Okay, it's kind of a two-pronged thing. Why would you create a new fourth industrial revolution and fill it full of old-fashioned people? That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Even winemakers know that. You know, you put new wine in new skins and not the other way around. So in their mind, and the World Economic Forum is very plain on this, they speak about transhumanism and the merging of technology and the human condition to create an augmented humanity. Some people call it H+, humanity 2.0, et cetera. And their whole idea is to, you know, move these individuals now, these augmented, genetically modified people into this new reset technocratic world that they're, you know, conjuring up. So on one hand, yes, it is a prop in the sense that it's ushering in sustainable development. That's the only option it's ever given, by the way. You never hear a plan B. There's no other option besides sustainable development. And who has the lock on that? Well, it's the World Economic Forum in cahoots with the United Nations. They got it all, they say. So there's multiple threads running through this whole thing. That's all I want to say. It's not so simple that we can just say, well, that's all it is. There's a lot of other things that have jumped on board with it as well, which leads you to believe this all was a very carefully scripted, orchestrated event in history, in human history. That somebody else has talked about that, I'm sure.
Virginie.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony and expertise. I only want to trace the responsibilities. You said that it was Brzezinski. He is well known for his controlling chaos theory. And you also say that he is really linked with the Rockefeller. Can we say that they are behind everything? I know
Brzezinski
is also behind the entertainment theory. that he exposed in 1995. And it seems that it's always the same people that are behind these theories that they created alone without the consent of the people. So.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely that's very astute, and I think it's absolutely correct. There has been a limited number of people behind this whole concept from day one, and of course. In 1973, Rockefeller represented the banking world. He was chairman of Chase Manhattan, or well, Chase Bank at the time, now J.P. Morgan Chase. And his family, of course, was involved in oil back before the 1900. And they were part of that global financial crowd that we now struggle with the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the central banks of the world, the Bank for International Settlements. This group of people, Rockefeller included, were central, for instance, in the inner core committees of the Bank for International Settlements, for example. They created monetary policy for the whole world. They created economic policy for the whole world. And we see the same crowd today. Back then, when they started the Trilateral Commission, just to give you a European flavor, Rockefeller and Brzezinski traveled to Europe in 1972 to visit the then meeting of the Bilderberg Group that was meeting in Europe, to float a trial balloon to see, well, do you think this would work? Because it was something new for them. They didn't just want to go out and do it. So they went and they collaborated and asked questions of the people that attended the Bilderberg Conference that year, which are very similar in nature to the World Economic Forum today. And they gave universal approval. The literature says now. They gave universal approval to it. You go for it, we'll be right behind you. So they weren't the only ones. The 300 members that they took into the Trilateral Commission on day one were not the only ones in the world that were involved with this thing. There were other people that were on the periphery, on the outside, say, okay, you guys are, to use the American term, you are SEAL Team 6 to us. You're going to take the beachhead. We'll be right behind you with the big guns and the boats and, you know, whatever to conquer the rest of whatever needs to be conquered. And this is what we've seen over the years. But it was something new back then, and it was engineered within the banking elite circles. This of course, rings true for just my co-author back in the 70s, Professor Anthony Sutton, has written books on this that were censored on one hand, but greatly accepted on another by another group of people, wrote about Wall Street, for instance, and the rise of Hitler, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, Wall Street and the national suicide of the United States. He wrote, you know, he did research and wrote about these things. This is the same crowd. In some sense, it's the same. You see kind of the same modus operandi with this banking crowd. They're still after the same old thing, global domination. Rockefeller, I'll just mention this in passing. You didn't ask, but I'm going to say it anyway. Rockefeller understood, because gold had just been decoupled from currency, especially the dollar. Rockefeller understood, as a monetary expert, that there would be an end one day to the fiat currencies of the world. He saw that. I mean, a fifth grader could have figured it out if he had a calculator and a piece of paper. There would be an end eventually to fiat currency. His dilemma was, being one of the richest bankers in the world, okay, what do you do when money disappears, when currency disappears? What do you do for an encore to keep your hand on the control of the levers of control? Well, you get the resources directly. If you own the resources directly, it doesn't matter what kind of a monetary system you put on top of it. It just doesn't matter. It could be buffalo chips. It could be Indian bees. It just doesn't matter. Anything you call currency at that point, if you own all the timber, you own all the farms, you own all the oil, the gas, the gold and the minerals and the nickel and everything comes out of the earth, if you own those resources and nobody else can get them, you're on top of the world. You own everything, and so you get to call all the shots. This, I believe, was Rockefeller's mindset at the time. And I saw that in writings also from other people in Europe at the time and that were attending the Bilderberg meetings. This was a new thing for them, because it kind of foreshadowed all things from the debt-based economics banking system that we had when the Federal Reserve was first created, the other central banks of the world were created. All those things, all those institutions were seen as eventually disappearing, and they were laying the groundwork for their future conquest. And that's where we are today.
Can I would like to ask a question, like with regard to motives and timing of the whole situation, the whole pandemic. Why do you think it might have been especially important to pull this whole thing off now?
Well, at the time, and I wrote January of 2020, by the way, that technocracy's coup d'etat was underway. It was based on my observation that the people pushing the initial panic were the same people that were pushing climate alarmism a month before. And I'd watched that for a long time. And we found out later, that was my first thought, we found out later about event 201 and how it appeared that the entire pandemic was very carefully scripted by that group of people that met for event 201. And I think that this schedule had been prominent in their mind for some time. You remember Christiana Figueres said, we have a timetable. In 2015, didn't know what that timetable was. I mean, who could? We don't have a crystal ball. But the fact that she said they have a timetable, and then this happens in 2020, speaks pretty clearly to me that this was it. That was just my hunch in January of 2020. But I think it's proven out now when you see the combined weight, the organizational weight of the entire United Nations coming behind us, and then forcing the entire medical community, the whole world, to follow suit. It speaks of massive orchestration of human effort. That can't just be done, you know, on the spur of the moment, any more than you could have a, you know, professional football league appear on the scene with 1 week notice. It doesn't happen that way. It takes years of planning. And I think they had been years in planning in this. And I'll just wager to say, at least from 2015, when Figueres declared we have a timetable, that means the timetable already existed before she said it. And I don't know how long, and can't find anything in the United Nations that would tell us how far back it goes from there. But they had a timetable to pull us off to get rid of capitalism. And I think this was it.
Patrick, one final question maybe. Did I get this right, that many of the crises that we've experienced, including this one, including the global warming crisis, were staged? And did I misunderstand you when you told us about the Great Depression, how that too was staged? Is that correct? Was that staged as well, according in your mind?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I laid no groundwork for that, but since you brought it up, yes, I do believe the Great Depression was staged, and the reason I do is because people who have studied the activities of our Federal Reserve back in that day realized that the Great Crash of 29, when the stock market, the bottom of the stock market just fell apart, that's what led to pictures of the people jumping out of windows on Wall Street, by the way, because they lost their fortunes virtually overnight. The Great Crash of 29 was caused by the central bank withdrawing money from the economic system. Mm-hmm. They'd allowed it to build up, and then all of a sudden they pulled the rug out from under it. Margin calls started to ensue because people had borrowed on credit. When they cut off the credit, people had to sell their stock, and it just resulted in a free fall that took the market into oblivion. The Depression followed after that for all the reasons that we could look at here. And I dare say that was one of the frontal assaults, mm-hmm. I believe, of that century. That was one, not the only one, that was one of the central assaults,
uh-huh.
or frontal assaults that took place. Another one probably was World War I. Another one was probably World War II. Professor Anthony Sutton wrote about both of those extensively.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we're sitting pretty much on the same precipice right now that we were in 1928. I hate to even use that comparison because it implies it can get really ugly really soon. But right now we have manipulation of monetary systems like we've never really seen before in history. And at this point, the only question is, will the banking system withdraw liquidity suddenly, inadvertently or on purpose, it doesn't matter. But will liquidity be drawn from the system? And if it is withdrawn from the system, prices will crash, period. That's an economic certainty. That's just, that's such solid monetary theory that nobody would really object to that. When you remove money from the system is going to deflate. It's just a question of how fast. And if you can start a good panic to do it first, it's going to go much further than it would have otherwise.
Obviously. So is it true that it's always the same small group of people or families who are in their desire to dominate the world, in this megalomaniac desire to dominate or control the world, first steal our assets and our money, and then go after our bodies and even our minds? Is that a correct assessment?
I think it is, and it's that's kind of the, I realize that's kind of the bumper sticker version of what's going on, right? It's really hard to kind of get the whole sense of it in such a short statement, but that would be a correct statement. There's been a narrow group throughout history of people who try to conquer and dominate other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're dealing with that today. We've dealt with it in the last 150 years. We're dealing with it today. And unfortunately, I suppose for us, is that they're very sneaky in their, you know, how they do it. And so this new pandemic scenario, we never really dealt with this like we are right now. Now, we had, you know, we had the swine flu. We had some other things happen, HIV that Anthony Fauci is involved. We've had other things over time that were, you could kind of see where they maybe wanted to take it further than it went. But today it's over the top. And everywhere you look, you see the same small number of people. Even in the World Economic Forum, by the way, their membership is roughly, I think it's a little over 1,000 corporations in the world. Well, that's not all the corporations that exist in the world. There's a lot more than 1,000. Oh, yeah. Why aren't they involved? Well, it's kind of because those are the families, those are the companies, those are the interlocks and the directors and, you know, sitting on multiple boards of directors and stuff. Those are the ones that are bought into creating the fourth industrial revolution for their own profit. Those are the ones who can clearly see the vision. And even within that group, we've noticed this before in our network analysis, even within the group of 1,000 companies, or even if you look at the Bank for International Settlements with their central bank directors all coming to their board meetings, there's always an inner core in these groups, in these network groups like this. So the World Economic Forum has an inner core. Who's involved with it? Somebody like Mark Benoit? Certainly. Somebody like Angela Merkel? Certainly. Somebody like Klaus Schwab? Absolutely. He started it. But you've got an inner core that are kind of calling the shots for all the rest of them. But if that inner core is, say, 2% or 5%, the other 95% are kowtowing to what that 2% or 5% bring out to say.
Mm-hmm.
This is the way it is in the banking world, and is, you know, pretty much any click you get a hold of, there's always some inner core that's kind of controlling the whole thing. That's an even smaller group.
Luckily, Klaus Schwab gave us a really important piece of advice, because he said that there's only a small window of opportunity. Let's close it for him. And in order to understand why we should close it, we're going to play a very short clip, which I think is demonstrative of what this is all about. I think the people in this clip, most of them don't know what they're talking about, but they're giving us great secrets. Let us see.
Features of this fourth industrial revolution is that it doesn't change what we are doing,
but it changes us.
The very idea of human being some sort of natural concept is really going to change. Up until now, the conversation we've been having is around freedom of speech. Once we can access people's thoughts and access people's emotions.
The focus, as all of you know today, is on what's now called the Internet of Bodies, involving medical implants and other kinds of devices that go inside your body and all together with the Internet as a whole comprise the Internet of Bodies.
The Internet of Bodies, or IOB, is actually an ecosystem. It's a bunch of devices that are connected to the Internet that contain software and that either collect personal health data about you or can alter the body's function. We think of the Internet of Bodies as this collection of all these devices as well as all the data that the devices are gathering about you. And in healthcare, it's Internet of Bodies has been around for quite a while.
So the Internet of Bodies, imagine the power of AI. What is artificial intelligence? It's a way to automate computation and cognition. So we can now automate learning, perceiving, doing computation. It's a pervasive general purpose technology that will be used in all of our industries, that will come into our professional networks, our private networks, our schools, our industries and our offices. What I wanted to epitomize with the Internet of Bodies is this notion that we will be under assessment, we will be under measure of computation in every aspect of our lives in the future, from what you eat, who you date, what you buy on the Internet, how much energy you use, but also what are your vital signs, how well are you doing in terms of health, what kind of specific genetic quirks do you have, what's your genome telling about your health, about your mental health, about how well you are doing, how well you are aging, what kind of disease you are susceptible to.
It has a bit of an Orwellian twinge to it.
Well.
So that is the opportunity that they are talking about when they're saying there's only a small window of opportunity to introduce this. Let's close it for them.
Can I have one more question? Like, I mean, since this has gone quite far, so what is the, do you think there's like a plan B for them in case it doesn't go through? I mean, even with the help of like now creating new scares like Ukraine, like the other things that you mentioned, like these, you know, supply chain problems and what else you could manufacture. But say it doesn't go through. I mean, it seems hard to find a way back, I mean, to some sort of normality that people wouldn't look, you know, wouldn't see through, that it's kind of maybe not, you know, that something else has gone on in the meantime, because it's a totally different situation, like when we compare to, for instance, this, let's call it attempt during the swine flu or other things to change things around. I mean, this has gone really far and the masks are pretty down, I would say. What do you think, they have something, some idea to withdraw controlledly?
And the window that we have, their window of opportunity may be closing on that, but here's the danger. These people have immense power. They have immense money behind them, and they have immense networks of people to get things done. When you corner an angry bear, and you shoot and wound that bear, the bear won't be cornered very long because they have a way of coming after the one who did the wounding and in a very vicious way. I think we're dealing with a very vicious, immoral, amoral, you know, completely criminal type of an element that will do anything in their power to do to not be defeated, whatever that case is. So this is one warning to me personally, is that we must be ever vigilant for changing directions in this angry bear. And who knows what that could be. I'm not going to even speculate. There's a few things I've been looking at, but you all probably are aware of some things that, you know, you're looking at and you're very concerned, like war in Ukraine with Russia and so on. Maybe that will happen, maybe it won't, but, you know, Europe has already had two wars at the hands of these megalomaniacs. Another one probably isn't going to concern them too much. If it gets them out of Dutch, yeah, so what if you lose 500,000 people in a war? You know, it just, that's a chump change to them. And they've lost plenty of people in history to wars that they started and didn't blink an eye. So we're dealing with a very dangerous adversary. And the only answer, in my opinion, this is maybe a pathetic answer, we need to get these people out of public policy. That's the key thing. We can't say we're going to go kill them. That's not right. You can't go around killing people. We'd be just like them. But we need to extricate these people from all public policy platforms everywhere. Every local community, every province or state community, every national community, national governments, wherever they might be, these people need to be removed from positions of public policy where they can lord it over, if you will, other people and do these kinds of things. And that may be impossible to do. It may be difficult to do. I don't know yet. I'm not, you know, that's not my area, but I see that as being one. And Professor Desmond, by the way, who I know has already addressed the group, he boils it down like this, saying, you know, the issue of mass formation psychosis, which creates a scapegoat for one and also has people who are Looney Tunes on the other hand. The only defense, he says, against mass formation psychosis is free speech. That blew my mind when I first heard that from him. Free speech. I'm involved in free speech movement here in America called Citizens for Free Speech. When I heard that, my antenna went up, and I thought about why. When the scapegoat is silenced, he said this, actually. I'm not quoting, don't quote me. He said that. When the scapegoat is silenced, the killing begins. That is sobering to me, really sobering. So we need to keep the lines of communication open, like you folks are doing here with this hearing. Keep the lines of communications open and refuse to shut up. No matter how much they tell you, you're going to be quiet, we're going to censor you, we're going to deplatform you, we're going to do this to you, that to you. In China, they just disappear you. They're not doing that here, fortunately, yet. I don't think they are in Europe either. But we need to never, ever be quiet. Not again. That's not an option. We must keep speaking regardless of who we're speaking to. We have to keep the dialogue going.